daughter Nell and her husband, William McAdoo, Secretary of the Treasury. Wilson could give the incident only scant attention, however. At the time, his wife lay gravely ill, and this alone consumed his heart and mind. He cautioned his daughter, "Don't tell your mother anything about it." The dispute between Austria and Serbia could have ended there, a small war against a disruptive Balkan country. But within a week, the brush fire gusted into a firestorm, spiking fears, resurrecting animosities, triggering alliances and understandings, and setting long-laid plans in motion. On Tuesday, August 4th, following the Schlieffen Plan, German forces entered Belgium, dragging behind them giant fortress-busting guns capable of launching shells weighing 2,000 pounds apiece. Britain declared war, siding with Russia and France, the Allies. Germany and Austria-Hungary linked arms as the Central Powers. That same day, Wilson declared America to be neutral in an executive proclamation that barred the warships of Germany and Britain and all other belligerents from entering U.S. ports. Later, a week after his wife's funeral, struggling against his personal grief to address the larger trauma of the world, Wilson told the nation, "We must be impartial in thought as well as in action, must put a curb upon our sentiments as well as upon every transaction that might be construed as a preference of one party to the struggle before another." He had the full support of the American public. A British journalist, Sidney Brooks, writing in the North American Review, gauged America to be just as isolationist as ever. "And why not?" he asked. "The United States is remote, unconquerable, huge, without hostile neighbors or any neighbors at all of anything like her own strength, and lives exempt in an almost unvexed tranquility from the contentions and animosities and the ceaseless pressure and counterpressure that distract the close-packed older world." While easy in concept, neutrality in practice was a fragile thing. As the fire grew, other alliances were forged. Turkey joined the Central Powers, Japan the Allies. Soon fighting was underway in far-flung corners of the world, on land, in the air, and on the sea. And even under the sea, with German submarines ranging as far as the waters off Britain's western shores, an isolated dispute over a murder in the Balkans had become a world conflagration. The main arena, however, was Europe, and there Germany made clear that this would be a war like no other, in which no party would be spared. As Wilson mourned his wife, German forces in Belgium entered quiet towns and villages, took civilian hostages, and executed them to discourage resistance. In the town of Dinant, German soldiers shot 612 men, women, and children. The American press called such atrocities acts of frightfulness, the word then used to describe what later generations would call terrorism. On August 25th, German forces began an assault on the Belgian city of Louvain, the Oxford of Belgium, a university town that was home to an important library. 3 days of shelling and murder left 209 civilians dead, 1,100 buildings incinerated, and the library destroyed, along with its 230,000 books, priceless manuscripts, and artifacts. The assault was deemed an affront not just to Belgium, but to the world. Wilson, a past president of Princeton University, felt deeply the destruction of Louvain, according to his friend Colonel House. The president feared the war would throw the world back 3 or 4 centuries. Each side had been confident of a victory within months, but by the end of 1914, the war had turned into a macabre stalemate marked by battles in which tens of thousands of men died and neither side gained ground. The first of the great named battles were fought that autumn and winter, the Frontier, Mons, Marne, and the First Battle of Ypres. By the end of November, after 4 months of fighting, the French army had suffered 306,000 fatalities, roughly equivalent to the 1910 population of Washington, D.C. The German toll was 241,000. By year's end, a line of parallel trenches constituting the Western Front ran nearly 500 miles from the North Sea to Switzerland, separated in places by a no-man's land of as little as 25 yards. For Wilson, already suffering depression, it was all deeply troubling. He wrote to Colonel House, "I feel the burden of the thing almost intolerably from day to day." He expressed a similar sentiment in a letter to his ambassador to Britain, Walter Hines Page. "The whole thing is very vivid in my mind, painfully vivid, and has been almost ever since the struggle began," he wrote. "I think my thought and imagination contain the picture and perceive its significance from every point of view. I have to force myself not to dwell upon it to avoid the sort of numbness that comes from deep apprehension and dwelling upon elements too vast to be yet comprehended or in any way controlled by counsel." There was at least one moment, however, when his grief seemed to lessen. In November 1914, he traveled to Manhattan to visit Colonel House. That evening, at about 9 o'clock, the two men set out for a walk from House's apartment, not in disguise, but also not advertising the fact that the President of the United States was now strolling the streets of Manhattan. They walked along 53rd Street to 7th Avenue to Broadway, somehow managing not to draw the attention of passers-by. They stopped to listen to a couple of sidewalk orators, but here Wilson was recognized and a crowd gathered. Wilson and Colonel House moved on, now followed by a trailing sea of New Yorkers. The two men entered the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, stepped up to the elevator, and directed the startled operator to stop at a high floor. They got off, walked to the opposite end of the hotel, found another bank of elevators, and returned to the lobby, then exited through a side door. After a brief walk along Fifth Avenue, they caught a city bus and rode it uptown to House's building. As exhilarating as this escape may have been, it was no cure for Wilson's malaise. On their return, Wilson confessed to House that as they were out walking, he had found himself wishing that someone would kill him. In the midst of this darkness, Wilson still managed to see America as the world's last great hope. "We are at peace with all the world," he said in December 1914 in his annual address to Congress. In January, he dispatched Colonel House on an unofficial mission to Europe to attempt to discover the conditions under which the Allies and the Central Powers might be willing to begin peace negotiations. House booked passage on the largest, fastest passenger ship then in service, the Lusitania, and traveled under a false name. On entering waters off Ireland, the ship's then captain, Daniel Dow, following a tradition accepted in times of war, raised an American flag as a ruse de guerre to protect the ship from attack by German submarines. The act startled House and caused a sensation aboard, but as a means of disguise, it had questionable value. America did not operate any liners of that size, with that distinctive four-funnel silhouette. The incident highlighted the press of forces threatening to undermine American neutrality. The battles in Europe posed no great worry, with the United States so distant and secure within its oceanic moat. It was Germany's new and aggressive submarine war that posed the greatest danger. At the beginning of the war, neither Germany nor Britain understood the true nature of the submarine, or realized that it might produce what Churchill called this strange form of warfare hitherto unknown to human experience. Only a few prescient souls seemed to grasp that the design of the submarine would force a transformation in naval strategy. One of these was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who, a year and a half before the war, wrote a short story, not published until July 1914, in which he envisioned a conflict between England and a fictional country, Norland, one of the smallest powers in Europe. In the story, entitled Danger, Norland at first seems hopelessly overmatched, but the little country has a secret weapon, a fleet of 8 submarines, which it deploys off the coast of England to attack incoming merchant ships, both cargo and passenger. At the time Doyle conceived his plot, submarines did exist, but British and German naval commanders saw them as having little value. Norland's submarines, however, bring England to the verge of starvation. At one point, without warning, the commander of the submarine fleet, Captain John Sirius, uses a single torpedo to sink a White Star passenger liner, the Olympic. England eventually surrenders. Readers found that last attack particularly shocking because the Olympic was a real ship. Its twin had been the Titanic, lost well before Doyle wrote his story. Intended to sound the alarm and raise England's level of naval preparedness, the story was entertaining and frightening, but was widely deemed too far-fetched to be believable, for Captain Sirius's behavior would have breached a fundamental maritime code, the cruiser rules, or prize law, established in the 19th century to govern warfare against civilian shipping. Obeyed ever since by all seagoing powers, the rules held that a warship could stop a merchant vessel and search it, but had to keep its crew safe and bring the ship to a nearby port, where a prize court would determine its fate. The rules forbade attacks against passenger vessels. In the story, Doyle's narrator dismisses as a delusion England's belief that no nation would stoop to such levels. Common sense, Captain Sirius says, should have told her that her enemy will play the game that suits them best, that they will not inquire what they may do, but they will do it first and talk about it afterwards. Doyle's forecast was dismissed as too fantastic to contemplate. But Britain's own Admiral Jacky Fisher, credited with reforming and modernizing the British Navy, it was he who had conceived the first dreadnought, had also become concerned about how submarines might transfigure naval warfare. In a memorandum composed 7 months before the war, Fisher forecast that Germany would deploy submarines to sink unarmed merchant ships and would make no effort to save the ship's crews. The strengths and limitations of the submarine made this outcome inescapable, he argued. A submarine had no room to bring aboard the crew of a merchant ship and did not have enough men of its own to put a prize crew aboard. What's more, Fisher wrote, the logic of war required that if such a strategy were adopted, it would have to be pursued to the fullest extent possible. The essence of war is violence, he wrote, and moderation in war is imbecility. Churchill rejected Fisher's vision. The use of submarines to attack unarmed merchant ships without warning, he wrote, would be abhorrent to the immemorial law and practice of the sea. Even he acknowledged, however, that such tactics, when deployed against naval targets, constituted fair war. But early on, neither he nor his German counterparts expected the submarine to play much of a role in deep ocean battle. The strategic thinking of both sides centered on their main fleets, the British Grand Fleet and the German High Seas Fleet, and both anticipated an all-or-nothing Trafalgar-esque naval duel using their big battleships. But neither side was willing to be the first to come out in direct challenge of the other. Britain had more firepower, 27 dreadnought-class battleships to Germany's 16, but Churchill recognized that chance events could nullify that advantage if some ghastly novelty or blunder supervened. For added safety, the Admiralty based the fleet in Scapa Flow, a kind of island fortress formed by the Orkney Islands north of Scotland. Churchill expected Germany to make the first move, early and in full strength, for the German fleet would never be stronger than at the war's beginning. German strategists, on the other hand, recognized Britain's superiority and crafted a plan whereby German ships would make limited raids against the British fleet to gradually erode its power, a campaign that Germany's Admiral Reinhard Scheer called guerrilla warfare, borrowing a Spanish term for small-scale warfare in use since the early 19th century. Once the British fleet was pared down, Scheer wrote, the German fleet would seek a favorable opportunity for the climactic battle. So we waited, wrote Churchill, and nothing happened. No great event immediately occurred. No battle was fought. At the start of the war, the submarine barely figured in the strategic planning of either side. In those early days, wrote Hereward Hooke, a young British sailor, I do not think that anyone realized that a submarine could do any damage. He was soon to learn otherwise, in an incident that demonstrated in vivid fashion the true destructive power of submarines and revealed a grave flaw in the design of Britain's big warships. At dawn, on the morning of Tuesday, September 22, 1914, three large British cruisers, HMS Aboukir, Hogue, and Cressy, were patrolling a swath of the North Sea off Holland known as the Broad Fourteens, moving at 8 knots, a leisurely and, as it happened, foolhardy pace. The ships were full of cadets. Hooke, one of them, was 15 years old and assigned to the Hogue. The ships were old and slow, and so clearly at risk that within Britain's Grand Fleet they bore the nickname the Live Bait Squadron. Hooke, who in later life would indeed be promoted to Captain Hooke, was in his bunk asleep when at 6:20 a.m. he was awakened by a violent shaking of his hammock. A midshipman was trying to wake him and other cadets to alert them to the fact that one of the big cruisers, the Aboukir, had been torpedoed and was sinking. Hooke sprinted to the deck and watched the Aboukir begin to list. Within minutes the ship heeled and disappeared. It was, he wrote, my first sight of men struggling for their lives. His ship and the other intact cruiser, the Cressy, maneuvered to rescue the sailors in the water, each coming to a dead stop a few hundred yards away to launch boats. Hooke and his fellow crewmen were ordered to throw overboard anything that could float to help the men in the water. Moments later, two torpedoes struck his own ship, the Hogue, and in 6 or 7 minutes, she was quite out of sight, he wrote. He was pulled into one of the Hogue's previously launched lifeboats. After picking up more survivors, the lifeboat began making its way toward the third cruiser, the Cressy. But another torpedo was now tearing through the water. The torpedo struck the Cressy on its starboard side. Like the two other cruisers, the Cressy immediately began to list. Unlike the others, however, the list halted, and the ship seemed as if it might stay afloat. But then a second torpedo struck and hit the magazine that stored ammunition for the ship's heavy guns. The Cressy exploded and sank. Where just an hour earlier there had been three large cruisers, there were now only men, a few small boats, and wreckage. A single German submarine, Unterseeboot 9, U-9 for short, commanded by Captain Lieutenant Otto Wedekind, had sunk all three ships, killing 1,459 British sailors, many of them young men in their teens. Wedekind and his U-boat were, of course, to blame, but the design of the ships, their longitudinal coal bunkers, contributed greatly to the speed with which they sank, and thus the number of lives lost. Once ruptured, the bunkers caused one side of each ship's hull to fill quickly, creating a catastrophic imbalance. The disaster had an important secondary effect. Because two of the cruisers had stopped to help survivors of the initial attack and thus made themselves easy targets, the Admiralty issued orders forbidding large British warships from going to the aid of U-boat victims. Through the fall and winter of 1914, Germany's submarines came to occupy more and more of Wilson's attention, owing to a new shift in German naval strategy that brought with it the steadily worsening threat of entanglement. The Abukir incident and other successful attacks against British ships caused German strategists to view submarines in a new light. The boats had proved to be hardier and deadlier than expected, well suited to Germany's guerrilla effort to abrade the strength of Britain's Grand Fleet. But their performance also suggested another use. By year's end, Germany had made the interception of merchant shipping an increasingly important role for the Navy, to stanch the flow of munitions and supplies to Allied forces. This task originally had fallen to the Navy's big auxiliary cruisers, former ocean liners converted to warships, but these cruisers had been largely swept from the seas by Britain's powerful navy. Submarines, by their nature, offered an effective means of continuing the campaign. They also raised the risk that an American ship might be sunk by accident, or that U.S. citizens traveling on Allied vessels might be harmed. Early in 1915, this risk seemed to increase sharply. On February 4th, Germany issued a proclamation designating the waters around the British Isles an area of war, in which all enemy ships would be subject to attack without warning. This posed a particularly acute threat to Britain, which, as an island nation that imported 2/3 of its food, was utterly dependent on seaborne trade. Neutral ships were at risk also, Germany cautioned, because Britain's willingness to fly false flags had made it impossible for U-boat commanders to rely on a ship's markings to determine whether it truly was neutral. Germany justified the new campaign as a response to a blockade begun previously by Britain, in which the British Navy sought to intercept all cargoes headed to Germany. Britain had more than twice as many submarines as Germany, but used them mainly for coastal defense, not to stop merchant ships. German officials complained that Britain made no attempt to distinguish whether the cargoes were meant for hostile or peaceful use, and charged that Britain's true goal was to starve civilians and thereby doom the entire population of Germany to destruction. What Germany never acknowledged was that Britain merely confiscated cargoes, whereas U-boats sank ships and killed men. German commanders seemed blind to the distinction. Germany's Admiral Scheer wrote, "Does it really make any difference, purely from the humane point of view, whether those thousands of men who drown wear naval uniforms or belong to a merchant ship bringing food and munitions to the enemy, thus prolonging the war and augmenting the number of women and children who suffer during the war?" Germany's proclamation outraged President Wilson. On February 10th, 1915, he cabled his formal response, in which he expressed incredulity that Germany would even think to use submarines against neutral merchant ships, and warned that he would hold Germany to a strict accountability for any incident in which an American ship was sunk or Americans were injured or killed. He stated further that America would take any steps it might be necessary to take to safeguard American lives and property, and to secure to American citizens the full enjoyment of their acknowledged rights on the high seas. The force of his prose took German leaders by surprise. Outwardly, Germany seemed a fierce monolith, united in carrying out its war against merchant ships. But in fact, the new submarine campaign had caused a rift at the highest levels of Germany's military and civilian leadership. Its most ardent supporters were senior naval officials. Its opponents included the commander of Germany's military forces in Europe, General Erich von Falkenhayn, and the nation's top political leader, Chancellor Theobald von Beckmann-Hollweg. Moral scruple had nothing to do with their opposition. Both men feared that Germany's undersea war could only lead to disaster by driving America to shed its neutrality and side with Britain. Wilson's protest, however, did not impress Germany's submarine zealots. They argued that, if anything, Germany should intensify its campaign and destroy all shipping in the war zone. They promised to bring Britain to heel well before America could mobilize an army and transport it to the battlefield. Both camps maneuvered to win the endorsement of Kaiser Wilhelm, who, as the nation's supreme military leader, had the final say. He authorized U-boat commanders to sink any ship, regardless of flag or markings, if they had reason to believe it was British or French. More importantly, he gave the captains permission to do so while submerged, without warning. The most important effect of all this was to leave the determination as to which ships were to be spared, which to be sunk, to the discretion of individual U-boat commanders. Thus, a lone submarine captain, typically a young man in his 20s or 30s, ambitious, driven to accumulate as much sunk tonnage as possible, far from his base and unable to make wireless contact with superiors, his vision limited to the small and distant view afforded by a periscope, now held the power to make a mistake that could change the outcome of the entire war. As Chancellor Bateman would later put it, unhappily, it depends upon the attitude of a single submarine commander whether America will or will not declare war. No one had any illusions. Mistakes would happen. One of Kaiser Wilhelm's orders included an acknowledgement of the risk. If, in spite of the exercise of great care, mistakes should be made, the commander will not be made responsible. Wilson's grief and loneliness persisted into the new year, but in March 1915, a chance encounter caused that curtain of gray to part. His cousin, Helen Woodrow Bones, lived in the White House, where she served as a proxy first lady. Often she went walking with a good friend, Edith Balling Galt, 43 years old, who happened also to be a friend of Wilson's physician, Dr. Grayson. At 5 feet 9 inches tall, with a full and shapely figure and a taste for fine clothes, including those designed in the Paris fashion house of Charles Frederick Worth, she was a striking woman, with a complexion and manners said to gleam, and eyes of a violet blue. One day, while riding in a limousine with Wilson, Dr. Grayson spotted Galt and bowed toward her, at which point the president exclaimed, "Who is that beautiful lady?" Born in October 1872 as the 7th of 11 siblings, Edith claimed family roots that dated back to Pocahontas and Captain John Rolfe. She grew up in a small Virginia town, Wytheville, in a landscape still warm with residual passions of the Civil War. While a teenager, she began making periodic visits to Washington, D.C., to visit her eldest sister, who had married into a family that owned one of Washington's finest jewelry stores, Galt and Brothers Jewelers, situated near the White House. The store was repairing Abraham Lincoln's watch at the time the Civil War began. On one visit, when Edith was in her 20s, she met Norman Galt, a cousin of her sister's husband, who shared management of the store with other members of the family. They married in 1896. Eventually, Norman bought out his relatives to become sole owner of the business. Edith bore a son in 1903, but the baby died within days. 5 years later, Norman died as well, suddenly, leaving substantial debts from his acquisition of the store. "It was a difficult time," Edith wrote. "I had no experience in business affairs and hardly knew an asset from a liability." She placed the store's day-to-day operations in the care of a seasoned employee, and with his help, the business began again to prosper, so that Edith, while retaining ownership, was able to withdraw from daily management. She became a skilled golfer and was the first woman in Washington to acquire a driver's license. She tooled around the city in an electric car. Her walks with Helen Bones usually began with Edith driving herself and Helen to Rock Creek Park in her car. Afterward, they invariably returned to Edith's house in DuPont Circle for tea. But one afternoon in March 1915, Helen arrived at Edith's home in a White House car, which took them to the park. At the end of the walk, Helen suggested that this time they have tea at her place, the White House. Edith resisted. The walk had been a messy one. Her shoes were muddy, and she did not want to be seen by the President of the United States in this condition. As she told Helen, she feared being taken for a tramp. In fact, shoes aside, she looked pretty good, as she herself later noted, with a smart black tailored suit which Worth had made for me in Paris, and a tricot hat which I thought completed a very good-looking ensemble. Helen insisted. "There is not a soul there," she told Edith. "Cousin Woodrow is playing golf with Dr. Grayson, and we will go right upstairs in the elevator, and you shall see no one." They rode to the second floor. As they emerged, they ran headlong into the President and Grayson, both of whom were in their golf clothes. Grayson and Wilson joined the women for tea. Edith wrote later, "This was the accidental meeting which carried out the old adage of turn a corner and meet your fate." She noted, however, that the golf clothes Wilson had been wearing were not smart. Soon afterward, Helen invited Edith to a dinner at the White House, set for March 23rd. Wilson sent his Pierce Arrow to pick her up and to collect Dr. Grayson as well. Edith wore a purple orchid and sat at Wilson's right. "He is perfectly charming," she wrote later, "and one of the easiest and most delightful hosts I have ever known." After dinner, the group went upstairs to the second floor oval room for coffee and a fire, and all sorts of interesting conversation. Wilson read three poems by English authors, prompting Edith to observe that, as a reader, he is unequaled. The evening had a profound effect on Wilson. He was entranced. Edith, 16 years his junior, was an attractive and compelling woman. White House usher Irwin Ike Hoover called her an impressive widow. That evening, Wilson's spirits soared. He had little time to dwell in this new hopeful state, however. 5 days later, on March 28, 1915, a British merchant ship, the Falaba, encountered a U-boat commanded by Georg Günther Freiherr von Forstner, one of Germany's submarine aces. The ship was small, less than 5,000 tons, and carried cargo and passengers bound for Africa. A sharp-eyed lookout first saw the submarine when it was 3 miles off and alerted the Falaba's captain, Frederick Davies, who turned his ship full away and ordered maximum speed, just over 13 knots. Forstner gave chase. He ordered his gun crew to fire a warning shot. The Falaba kept running. Now Forstner, using flags, signaled, "Stop, or I fire." The Falaba stopped. The U-boat approached, and Forstner, shouting through a megaphone, notified Captain Davies that he planned to sink the vessel. He ordered Davies and all aboard, 242 souls, to abandon ship. He gave them 5 minutes. Forstner maneuvered to within 100 yards. The last lifeboat was still being lowered when he fired a torpedo. The Falaba sank in 8 minutes, killing 104 people, including Captain Davies. A passenger by the name of Leon C. Thrasher was believed among the lost, though his body was not recovered. Thrasher was a citizen of the United States. The incident, condemned as the latest example of German frightfulness, was exactly the kind of thing Wilson had feared, for it held the potential to raise a cry for war. "I do not like this case," he told his Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan. "It is full of disturbing possibilities." Wilson's first instinct was to issue an immediate denunciation of the attack, in sharp language, but subsequent discussion with his cabinet and with Secretary Bryan caused him to hold off. Bryan, a staunch pacifist, proposed that the death of an American who knowingly traveled aboard a British ship through a declared war zone might not even merit protest. To him, it seemed the equivalent of an American taking a stroll across the battlefield in France. In a note to Bryan on Wednesday, April 28th, the day after a cabinet meeting at which the Falaba incident was discussed, Wilson wrote, "Perhaps it is not necessary to make formal representations in the matter at all." Leon Thrasher, the American passenger, was still missing, his body presumably adrift in the Irish Sea. It was one more beat in a cadence that seemed to be growing faster and louder. Lusitania, Sucking Tubes and Thackeray. Throughout the week before departure, passengers who lived in New York started packing in earnest, while the many who came from elsewhere began arriving in the city by train, ferry, and automobile. They found the city steaming with heat, 91 degrees on Tuesday, April 27th, with 4 days yet to go until Straw Hat Day, Saturday, May 1st, when a man could at last break out his summer hats. Men followed this rule. A Times reporter did an impromptu visual survey of Broadway and spotted only 2 straw hats. Thousands of sweltering, uncomfortable men plodded along with their winter headgear at all angles on their uncomfortable heads or carried in their hot, moist hands. The city seemed untroubled by the war. Broadway, the Great White Way, so dubbed for its bright electric lighting, came brilliantly alight and alive each night, as always, although now with unexpected competition. A number of restaurants had begun providing lavish entertainment along with meals, even though they lacked theater licenses. The city was threatening a crackdown on these maverick cabarets. One operator, the manager of Reisenweber's at 8th Avenue in Columbus Circle, said he would welcome a ban. The competition was wearing him out. His establishment was running a musical review called Too Much Mustard, featuring a host of beautiful girls and a separate whirlwind cabaret with a quintet of minstrels and a full lunch, table d'hôte, for a buck, with dancing between courses. "The public," he complained, "is making such ridiculous demands for elaborate entertainment with meals that it is really dangerous for everybody in the restaurant business." In case any of the newly arrived passengers needed some last-minute clothing for the voyage, there was New York's perennial attraction, shopping. Spring sales were underway or about to begin. Lord & Taylor on 5th Avenue was advertising men's raincoats for $6.75, less than half their usual price. B. Altman, a few blocks south, didn't deign to list actual prices, but assured female shoppers they would find decided reductions in the cost of gowns and suits from Paris, these to be found on its third floor in the Department of Special Costumes. And strangely, a tailor of German heritage, House of Kruppenheimer, was advertising a special suit, the British. The company's ads proclaimed, "All men are young in these stirring days." The city's economy, like that of the nation as a whole, had by now improved dramatically owing to the wartime boost in demand for American wares, especially munitions. The lull in shipping had ended. By year's end, the United States would report a record trade surplus of $1.5 billion, or $35.9 billion today. Real estate, Ever an obsession in New York was booming, with large buildings under construction on the east and west sides. Work was about to begin on a new 12-story apartment building at the corner of 88th and Broadway. Expected cost, $500,000. There were extravagant displays of spending. It's possible that some of the Lusitania's first-class passengers attended a big party at Delmonico's the Friday night before departure, thrown by Lady Grace Mackenzie, the Huntress, as the Times described her. The party had a jungle theme, with 50 guests, among them explorers, hunters, zoologists, two cheetahs, and a black ape. Delmonico's had filled the banquet room with palm trees and layered the walls with palm fronds to create the effect of dining in an African glade. Black men in tights and white tunics kept watch on the animals, though in fact the black pigment proved to be the effect of burned cork and low lighting. The list of appetizers included stuffed eagle's eggs. Although the city's newspapers carried a lot of war news, politics and crime tended to dominate the front page. Murder was a fascination, as always. On Thursday, April 29th, in the midst of the heat wave, a city produce merchant who had recently lost his job sent his wife to the movies, then shot his 5-year-old son to death and killed himself. A Bridgeport, Connecticut man presented his girlfriend with an engagement ring and handed her one end of a ribbon. The other end disappeared into his pocket. "A surprise," he said, and urged her to pull it. She obliged. The ribbon was attached to the trigger of a revolver. The man died instantly. And on Friday, April 30th, 4 criminals escaped from the drug ward at Bellevue Hospital wearing pink pajamas. 3 of the men were found, after a thorough search of the neighborhood by policemen, hospital attendants, and small boys, the Times said. The 4th man was at large, presumably still dressed in pink. And there was this. A report that plans had been completed for a ceremony to dedicate a memorial fountain to Jack Phillips, wireless operator aboard the Titanic, and to 8 other Marconi operators likewise killed in maritime disasters. The article noted, "Space is left for the addition of other names in the future." The Lusitania's roster of passengers included 949 British citizens, including residents of Canada, 71 Russians, 15 Persians, 8 French, 6 Greeks, 5 Swedes, 3 Belgians, 3 Dutch, 2 Italians, 2 Mexicans, 2 Finns, and 1 traveler each from Denmark, Spain, Argentina, Switzerland, Norway, and India. The American complement, by Cunard's official tally, totaled 189. They came from locales throughout the country. 2 men from Virginia were officials of a shipbuilding company on their way to Europe to explore the acquisition of submarines. At least 5 passengers hailed from Philadelphia, others from Tuckahoe, New York, Braceville, Ohio, Seymour, Indiana, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, Hancock, Maryland, and Lake Forest, Illinois. A number came from Los Angeles, the Blicks, husband and wife, traveling in first, and 3 members of the Bretherton family in third. Christ traveled among them as well. Christ Gary, of Cleveland, Ohio, in second class. They stayed in hotels and boarding houses, or with family and friends, at addresses in all parts of the city. At least 6 stayed at the Hotel Astor, another 6 at the Biltmore. They arrived at intervals during the week, bearing mountains of luggage. Cunard allowed each passenger 20 cubic feet. They brought trunks, some brightly colored, red, yellow, blue, green, and others with surfaces of leather embossed with checkerboard and herringbone patterns braced with wood. They brought extension suitcases for transporting dresses, gowns, tuxedos, and business suits. The largest of these could hold 40 men's suits. They brought large boxes built especially for footwear, and these smelled pleasantly of polish and leather. They carried smaller luggage as well, mindful of what they would need while aboard and of what could be left in the ship's baggage hold. Passengers arriving by train could check the most cumbersome bags straight through from their cities of origin to their staterooms or to the baggage hold of the ship, with confidence that their belongings would be there when they boarded. They brought their best clothes, and in some cases their only clothes. The dominant palette was black and gray, but there were cheerier items as well. A heliotrope and white checked frock, a boy's red knitted jacket with white buttons, a green velveteen belt. Babies complicated things. Their clothing was intricate. A single outfit for one infant boy consisted of a white wool wrapper, a white cotton bodice edged with red and blue piping, overalls of blue cotton embroidered with dotted squares, plaited down the front, fastened in back with white buttons, a gray wool jacket with four ivory buttons, black stockings, and shoes with straps. He topped this off with a sucking tube, or pacifier, tied around his neck with cord. The wealthiest passengers carried rings, brooches, pendants, necklaces, and necklets, embedded with diamonds, sapphires, rubies, and onyx, and sardonyx, its red sister. They brought bonds and notes and letters of introduction, but also cash. A 35-year-old woman brought five $100 bills, another 11 50s. Everyone seemed to carry a watch, invariably in a gold case. One woman brought her Geneva-made Raymond III Cylindre 10 Ruby Medaille d'Or, number 220063, gold but with a face the color of blood. Later, the serial numbers of these watches would prove invaluable. Passengers brought diaries, books, pens, ink, and other devices with which to kill time. Ian Holborn, the famed writer and lecturer now returning from a speaking tour of America, brought along the manuscript of a book he had been working on for 2 decades, about his theory of beauty, whose pages now numbered in the thousands. It was his only copy. Dwight Harris, a 31-year-old New Yorker from a wealthy family, brought with him an engagement ring. He had plans. He also had concerns. On Friday, April 30th, he went to the John Wanamaker department store in New York and bought a custom life belt. Another man packed a gold seal for stamping wax on the back of an envelope with the Latin motto, Tuta Tenebo, I will keep you safe. First-class passenger Charles Emilius Laureate, Jr., a Boston bookseller, carried several items of particular value. Laureate, 40, was a good-looking man, with an attentive gaze and well-trimmed brown hair. Since 1894, he had been president of one of the country's best-known bookstores, Charles E. Laureate Company, at 385 Washington Street in Boston, several blocks from Boston Common, this at a time when a book dealer could achieve national recognition. It was the golden age of American book collecting, according to one historian, when some of the nation's great private collections were amassed, later to become treasured libraries, such as the Morgan in New York and the Folger in Washington. Laureate was an accomplished swimmer and yachtsman who played water polo and regularly raced his 18-foot sailboat and served as a judge in regattas that took place off the New England coast each summer. The Boston Globe called him a born boat sailor. Something of a celebrity himself, at least in literary circles, he dined regularly at the city's Players Club, often with one of the foremost critics and poets of the age, William Stanley Braithwaite. The store, originally situated directly opposite Boston's Old South Church, had been founded by Laureate's father and a partner, Dana Estes, in 1872, under the name Estes and Laureate, which also published books. 3 years later, the two partners divided the business into two companies, with Laureate taking over the retail side. By the time of the split, the store had already become a Boston institution, as much a debating society as it was a bookshop, according to one account. It served as a meeting place for writers, readers, intellectuals, and artists, and included among its regular customers Ralph Waldo Emerson and Oliver Wendell Holmes. The elder laureate was said to see himself as a guide, counselor, and friend to his customers, and produced in the store an atmosphere that one newspaper writer called homeness. The store was long and narrow and jutted far inward from the street, more mineshaft than showroom, with books shoring the walls all the way to the high ceilings and stacked on counters down the center. A flight of stairs led to a balcony full of collector's books and association books, those made valuable because their owners had been famous or otherwise noteworthy. One attraction for book aficionados was the store's old book room in the basement, filled with great gems that, according to a privately published history of the store, had come into the marketplace mainly through the breaking up of old English country house libraries. The display windows on Washington Street drew crowds of onlookers at lunch hour. Rare books were displayed in the windows on one side of the front door, new books on the other, including those with the most garish covers, known even then as bestsellers. One popular American author who turned out a bestseller every year was named, oddly enough, Winston Churchill. The store was one of the first to sell remainders, stocks of once popular books that remained unsold after the initial surge of sales, and that publishers were willing to sell to Laureate at a deep discount. He in turn sold them to customers for a fraction of their original price, a side of the business that grew so popular, the store began printing a remainder catalog, released each fall. But the thing that set Laureate apart from other booksellers from the beginning was the elder laureate's decision to make an annual trip to London to buy up old books and sell them in America for far higher prices, leveraging the differential in demand that existed on opposite sides of the Atlantic, while also taking advantage of the falling prices and faster speeds of shipping brought by the advent of transatlantic steamships. Laureate made his first trip in 1873 on one of Cunard's earliest steamers, the Atlas. His purchases routinely made news. One acquisition of a Bible dating to 1599, a Geneva or Breeches Bible, so named because it used the word breeches to describe what Adam and Eve wore, drew nearly a full column in the New York Times. By century's end, the store had become one of the country's leading sellers and importers of rare books, manuscripts, and illustrations, its bookplates destined to be treasured by future bibliophiles. Charles Laureate, Jr. continued his father's transatlantic harvest, and in that last week of April 1915 was preparing to set out on his next buying trip. As always, Laureate planned to stay in London for several months while he hunted for books and writerly artifacts to acquire, these to be crated and shipped back by sea to Boston. He transported his most valuable finds in his personal baggage and never thought to insure them against loss, for the risk, as he put it, is practically nil. Nor did the war prompt him to change his practice. "We considered the passenger steamers immune from submarine attack," he wrote. He bought his ticket, number 1297, from a Cunard agent in Boston, and while doing so asked whether the liner would be convoyed through the war zone. The clerk replied, "Oh, yes, every precaution will be taken." Laureate chose the Lusitania specifically because of its speed. Ordinarily, he preferred small, slow boats. But this year, he wrote, "I wanted to make my business trip as short as possible." At the Lusitania's top speed of 25 knots, he expected to arrive in Liverpool on Friday, May 7th, and reach London in time to start work on Saturday morning, May 8th. He planned to travel with a friend, Lothrop Withington, an authority on genealogy who had a particular expertise in the old records of Salem, Massachusetts, and Canterbury, England. Both men were married, but for this trip were leaving their wives behind. Laureate had four children, one a baby, whose picture he planned to bring along. He packed five pieces of luggage, a leather briefcase, a small valise, an extension suitcase, a large shoe case, and his steamer trunk. Dinner required formal wear and all that went with it. His various day suits required shoes of differing styles. There were braces and socks, ties and cufflinks. He also packed his favorite knickerbocker suit with its characteristic knickers, which he planned to wear while strolling the deck. He and Withington were set to take the midnight train to New York on Thursday, April 29th, but first Laureate stopped at his bookstore. There a colleague opened the store's safe and handed him two volumes, each with a cover that measured 12 by 14 inches. These were scrapbooks, but of a high order. One contained 54 line drawings, the other 64 drawings, all done by the Victorian author William Makepeace Thackeray to illustrate his own works. At one time, Thackeray, who died in 1863 and whose best-known work was Vanity Fair, had been nearly as popular as Charles Dickens, and his satirical stories, essays, and serialized novels were widely and avidly read in such magazines as Fraser's and Punch. His drawings and books, and just about any other artifact from his life, all known as Thackerayana, were coveted by collectors on both sides of the Atlantic, but especially in America. Laureate took the scrapbooks back to his home in Cambridge, where he inspected them in the company of his wife Marion. He then packed them carefully in his extension suitcase and locked it. At the station later that night, he checked his trunk and shoebox for transport direct to the Lusitania, but held back his other three pieces. He kept these with him in the rail car. He and Withington reached New York early the next morning, Friday, April 30th, the day before the Lusitania was scheduled to sail, and here they temporarily parted company. Laureate took a taxi to the home of his sister Blanche and her husband George W. Chandler at 235 West 71st Street in Manhattan. Laureate had one more task to complete before departure. At the Waldorf Astoria at 5th Avenue and 33rd Street, first-class passenger Margaret Mackworth, 31, packed her things in a fog of gloom and depression. She dreaded her return to England. It meant going back to a dead marriage of 7 years and a life oppressed by war. She had arrived in New York the previous month alone after a tedious 10-day crossing to join her father, D.A. Thomas, a prominent businessman who was already in the city for discussions on ventures ranging from mines to Mississippi barges. She was delighted and relieved to find him waiting for her on the dock. In 1915, to come out into sunlit April New York, carefree and happy after being under the heavy cloud of war at home, was an unspeakable relief, she recalled. The city charmed her. In the evenings, almost every evening, we went out, either to the theater or to dinner parties, she wrote. She bought dresses, paid for by her father, including a long black velvet gown that she loved. She saw her customary shyness, an annihilating shyness, begin to subside, and she began for the first time in her life to feel like a social asset to her father, rather than a liability. Her shyness, however, had not kept her from fighting for women's suffrage back in England, in the course of which she jumped on the running board of a prime minister's car and blew up a mailbox with a bomb. Those weeks of open-hearted American hospitality and forthcomingness, of frankly expressed pleasure in meeting one, did something for me that made a difference to the whole of the rest of my life, she wrote. She dropped her shyness overboard on that holiday. I have always been grateful to New York for that, she wrote. And finally, it was one of the last times when I consciously felt quite young. Although she and her father would be traveling in first class on one of the most luxurious vessels the world had known, all she felt now was sorrow and regret. That Friday morning, Captain Turner left the ship and made his way south to Wall Street, to the City Investing Building at 165 Broadway, an immense, ungainly